Welcome to a very special edition of Enclave On Air. I'm your host today, Gina Columbus. Enclave On Air is a podcast from Enclave, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Enclave covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. But today, we had the pleasure of sitting down with Patrick I. Borgen, MD, Chair of the Department of Surgery and Director of Breast Cancer at Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. Dr. Borgen has not only been the chair of PER's Miami Breast Cancer Conference, but also an advisory board member and past chair of Enclave's Giants of Cancer Care program. Some of his many research endeavors also focus on plans to remove the use of opioids from surgical oncology and the treatment of patients with breast cancer. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Borgen spent time reflecting on his monumental career, what drove him to be a breast cancer surgeon, and even a mentor and a patient who have had lasting impacts on his journey in oncology. Dr. Borgen, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me, Gina. I've been looking forward to getting together with you and talking.
Same. So excited.
Yeah, me too.
So let's get right down to it. Why did you really want to become a breast cancer surgeon? What path led you here?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I don't think about it very often because being involved in breast cancer at this moment in time is the greatest blessing that you could imagine. There's nothing in medicine that's been more exciting than the changes that we've seen with breast cancer. And so while I could give you an answer about, I was a general surgery resident and we did some research, I pretty much knew I wanted to do oncology. I wanted to treat a common disease. I wanted to tackle a disease where we didn't know much about it. And this was a long time ago. This was 30 years ago. And so luckily I stumbled across breast cancer. I got a volunteer job because there were no paid jobs in laboratories. At Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in 1989. I worked for free. I took out a bank loan, and I was placed in the Rockefeller Research Labs. And it was almost Forrest Gump, because it was the right place at the right time. The world was about to discover the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, and we were heavily involved in that search. And once the genes were sequenced and we understood them, then we had to learn about them. So the first 10 years of my life, we spent studying BRCA1 and BRCA2. And it was really the Wild West. We had no idea what to expect. The genes were not well understood back then. And so I sometimes call it a Forrest Gump moment, where I was kind of in the right place at the right time. And of course, in 30 years, I've seen breast cancer go on this amazing journey, driven, by the way, by women, driven by advocates, driven by women who fought for more funding, who fought and fought and fought. I firmly believe breast cancer is 20 years ahead of prostate cancer in its fundamental understanding. So what an amazing ride. In 1989, the most common operation was a modified radical mastectomy. People were beginning to dabble in breast conservation. And of course, we saw a huge sea change with a transition from radical surgery to much more conservative surgery. And then we played a role in the development of sentinel node biopsy. So instead of taking 20 lymph nodes, we took two. And along the way, we developed different ways to give chemotherapy, different sequencing strategies, and new drugs were discovered. I was in the lab that did a lot of the fundamental work on a gene that became known as HER2, and clearly one of the top three most important advances in breast cancer has been the understanding of HER2 and using it as a therapeutic target, which has really saved thousands of lives. The thing that's been constant in my journey in breast cancer has been change. If you stop paying attention for a few months with breast cancer, there's a substantial chance of the field passing you by. So what an amazing time right now to be watching the drug development, the explosion of immunotherapy, improvements in surgery, improvements in radiation. It's just really every day is interesting.
Was there anything that was kind of behind fueling that passion to go down the more surgical route for breast cancer treatment?
Well, for me, I had a choice of how I would intervene. And I'm a very impatient person. And so what I liked about surgery was you could make things better or worse, but you did it quickly. And so the pace of surgery, the pace of the intervention was attractive to me. So many of my friends and colleagues who were so much smarter than I was chose medical oncology, very thoughtful, let's sit down, let's think about our options, very cerebral and vitally important. I just didn't have that personality. I had the, that's a problem, let's go fix it today mentality. And there's still a place for that. You know, surgery still, especially as we've evolved towards earlier and earlier stage of diagnosis with the transition from analog mammography to digital, from digital to 3D. Contrast mammography is on the horizon. We're finding breast cancers at an earlier and earlier stage. And that means that the role of surgery is more important today, because surgery today for these early non-palpable cancers gets you 90% of the way to the cure. So about 15 years ago, one of my mentors predicted the demise of breast surgery. Won't be a role in the future. And boy, that's been wrong. Now, do I eventually think certainly some of the larger operations we do will go away? I absolutely do. We know that systemic treatments will replace surgery. We know that capitalizing on our own immune system will be extremely important in the future. But for today, 2019, surgery is still really important, and doing it well is certainly important.
I'm glad you mentioned a mentor that you had. Can you talk about one or two mentors that you've had along the path in your career that have really shaped you to be where you are today?
Sure. I've been very lucky. I was hired at Sloan Kettering by Dr. Murray Brennan. Brennan is a New Zealander, came up in the New Zealand medical system, came to America, worked with Steve Rosenberg at the NCI in the earliest days of immunology, trained in Boston in the Harvard system, the Brigham and Women's, came to Sloan Kettering at a very young age, and at a very young age became the chairman of surgery. Dr. Brennan is the single smartest human being I've ever met in my life. A gentleman, a scholar, wise beyond his years. The biggest mistake he probably made was hiring me as an attending at Sloan. I started as a fellow at Sloan in 89. I became a junior attending in 91, and in 93, he promoted me to the chief of the division. I was 33 years old. I went to see him and I said, I think you're making a big mistake here. You do know I'm not only 33 years old, but I'm from Louisiana. You realize that. And so he assured me that he had confidence in me, which I felt like an imposter for a bunch of years. But with his support and his guidance and his wisdom, I stayed the chief for 17 years. And along the way, we were able to write a lot of the story of breast cancer. So he's my most important mentor. He's alive and well. We have dinner periodically. I'm nervous every time I meet with him. My father passed away in 1993, the year I became the chief. And Dr. Brennan really became a father figure to me. I bring typed notes to my dinners with him. Wow. So that I don't miss something that I want to ask him. So it's been an amazing, I believe Murray Brennan was the most important cancer surgeon in America for the second half of the 20th century. I think nobody else came close. He wrote over 1,500 articles. He was president of every society he ever joined, including the American Surgical Association, the Southern Surgical, the SSO, American College. There's not a single group that didn't immediately promote him to their top position. And so he's been a blessing in my life.
What would you say are some mottos as the years have gone by in your career that you have really lived by personally on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when you met Dr. Brennan, he would give you his 10 commandments. And some of them seemed kind of funny at the time, but he lived those 10 commandments. And part of what made Dr. Brennan who he was that he never stopped being self-critical. He had operated on one of the most famous women in America. He did a pancreatico duodenectomy for pancreas cancer, a so-called Whipple procedure. And the operation took 2 hours. It normally takes 6. She went home in 3 days, and she's alive and well 10 years later. So we had dinner a few months after the surgery, and it clearly went well. And I asked him whether he was nervous having all these news trucks parked around the hospital and literally news agencies following the operation minute by minute. And he started a diatribe about, well, during the operation, I did step 1, 3, 7, 5, and 8, and I normally do 2, 6, 5, and 9. And if I went back, I would redo. So here he is sitting at dinner. The patient has done well, but he's going through the steps in his mind. So that's an important lesson for surgeons. You have to learn something from every operation that you do, and there's nothing more valuable than being self-critical. What would I do different next time? I now head up our training program at Maimonides in Brooklyn, and this is one of the things that we spend a lot of time trying to inculcate in our trainees. Dr. Brennan had a saying that adulation was soporific. So I had to go to the dictionary twice on that one. So I looked up adulation and I looked up soporific. And I concluded that it meant that if someone praised you, you would get lazy. And that was sort of his motto. I remember I was able to publish a few books during my tenure at Sloan. And I would always proudly bring him the hardcover copy of the book. And I was really looking for the pat on the back and the attaboy. And he would say, have you started work on volume 2 yet? Can we just celebrate right. Volume 1?
Yep.
So he believed in being self-critical. He believed in hard work. He believed that the greatest blessing was to have a patient trust you enough to go to sleep and let you operate on them. It was a religion as well as a scientific calling. And so that's probably the most important lesson I learned from him.
So fast forward to today, where you're the chair and surgery director of the breast cancer program at Maimonides. So can you talk a little bit about some of the forward-thinking initiatives that the center is doing in the breast cancer space?
Sure. I left Sloan in 2007, partially, largely, to go to an underserved area. In 2007, there was not a cancer center in Brooklyn. A city of 3 million people. 2,000 women a year get breast cancer in Brooklyn. There was not a breast center. And so I joined a group that built the first and still the only comprehensive cancer center in Brooklyn. Really just a joy. My friends at Sloan thought I was having a terrible midlife crisis and that I might benefit from psychological counseling. But so what I was allowed to do was start with a blank piece of paper in Brooklyn and recruit my own team from start to finish. I've hired over 60 surgeons in Brooklyn since arriving. Maimonides has been magnificent in allowing me to do it my way. I recruit for values first and ability second. A lot of smart people out there. Smart and nice is much harder to find. And so the first and the largest forward-thinking initiative was building a different kind of a team. Surgeons, it might shock you to learn that surgeons have a certain reputation as sometimes not being the nicest guys out there. And that's, well, you know, you can imagine that someone who's going to remove your pancreas or your liver, I don't really care if he's a nice guy. I just want him to do a good job.
Right.
But the fact is that the old stereotype of surgeons is sort of a thing of the past. And surgeons have to be compassionate. They have to be kind. They have to listen to their patients. And so our biggest innovation is in the type of team that we've put together and really the quality of their work and the quality of the patient experience. Now, that leads me to all of our other, I think, advances, because when you get the right team that's compassionate and kind and self-critical, they immediately challenge the status quo. And about 6 years ago, we realized that there was an enormous opioid epidemic in the United States. And when we looked at the rate of growth of the number of American lives lost to opioid addiction, four-fifths of which started with a doctor's prescription for pain medication, we knew that we had to do something. And so over the last 4 or 5 years, we've developed a number of protocols across virtually all of surgery to simply eliminate opioids. We've just submitted a manuscript to a journal reporting on 800 consecutive breast cancer patients we treated without a single milligram of opioid given. Certainly a record in this country. So this whole idea of opioid sparing, opioid-free surgery falls under a larger heading, which is ERAS, Enhanced Recovery After Surgery. And we continue to work across 20 different subdivisions of surgery, making sure that we are paying attention to the use of opioids and really eliminating them from our practice.
I'm really glad that you brought up this issue. What else do you think as a society can we be doing to help fix this and make it less of an issue as more generations get older?
I think that's a great question. At the highest levels, some of the companies that have been involved in promoting opioids, and honestly, in dispensing misinformation about the safety of opioids, the use of opioids. I remember very dramatically in the 1990s attending a lecture where a prominent pain neurologist criticized us for not treating pain appropriately, saying you should use more opioids. You're depriving your patients of a pain-free existence. All of that was driven by a profit motive from some of the companies that were selling opioids. Almost all of the research back then was funded. So I think America is aware of this. I think that doctors are aware of it. The legal system is taking care of some of the real problem areas. Nevertheless, we haven't seen a slowing down in the death rate. In 2018, 72,000 Americans lost their lives to opioid addiction. For the very first time, and you have to think about this because it's a bit staggering, our average life expectancy declined for the last 3 years as a country. Wow. Now, we are the wealthiest nation on earth. We have the best healthcare delivery system. We have the best reporters like you.
Thank you.
So how is it that we're living shorter lives. And a big answer is the opioid epidemic. It is becoming much larger than the death rate from HIV/AIDS at the peak of that epidemic. And so I really think that as a society, we're becoming aware of it. But I think more doctors have to question their practice patterns. It's too easy to write the prescription for 50 Percocets and say, I don't want a phone call from Mrs. McGillicuddy tonight. So I think there has to be a mindset. At the Miami Breast Conference, which I'm delighted to chair, we have really focused on this for the past 4 or 5 years, and we've run parallel satellite symposiums. We've included these lectures in the plenary sessions, and the audience response has been fantastic, absolutely fantastic. So kudos to Miami for making this a priority. Imagine that we are 4 times more likely to cure a woman's breast cancer today than we were in 1990. But if we create an addict to opioids, to narcotics, then we've not done the right thing. So, very important.
Those are some great points. And I'm very happy that you brought up the Miami Breast Cancer Conference in Miami.
We love Miami.
We do. We love Miami. And you've been such a wonderful chair for this program, and it's so fresh and innovative each year. The agenda keeps changing and attendees keep coming back and they love it.
Yeah.
What would you say is the number one or two things that really set this conference apart from other breast cancer conferences that exist?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought up Miami. I like to tell people that I have 6 children. I have 2 boys, 3 girls, and Miami. And I've been involved with the Miami Breast Conference since the early 90s. This is our 35th, I believe, year. And Miami has been innovative, really, from its inception. Miami was the first international meeting to embrace an ultra-short time frame for lectures. We still do that today. So each speaker gets 15 minutes. The bitching and the moaning that we get from people who say, you want me to cover CDK4/6 inhibitors in 15 minutes? Yeah, I do. I want you to do that.
Yep.
So while the faculty doesn't like it, the audience loves it. So we have an information-dense program. We change the faculty every year. It's a new group of people. We base return invites to speak at Miami on the audience response. Smart person, good communicator, got their point across. Yes, that's effective. About 15% of our faculty won't make a return visit. And so the fundamental driving force has been this concept of practicality. We like to say, hear it Friday, use it on Monday. And we hold very true to that. There is basic science at Miami as it applies to tomorrow and the future, but it's never science for the sake of science. And we all love science, by the way. We go to meetings all the time where fundamental science is important. Our audience in Miami are in the trenches, surgeons, oncologists, radiation oncologists, NPs, nurses, physical therapists, who are treating hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of women every year. We once estimated that about 15% of all the breast cancer in America each year is treated by doctors who attended Miami. So think about the impact we're having. So we have with the help of PER and OncLive, we've been innovative. We've brought in patients to tell their stories. We have debates, medical crossfire debates, which we love.
Yep.
We've had sessions on physician burnout. We started something 2 years ago that I'm incredibly excited about, which is a session on breaking bad news. We call it Exigent Matters. And this is really cool. The audience is given 6 bad news scenarios. Your scan shows brain mets. The drug I'm using isn't working. You don't qualify for this trial. And then they choose one of our faculty. And we have an actress on stage.
Okay.
And the audience picks the bad news and the deliverer of the bad news. And then for about 12 or 15 minutes, one of our colleagues breaks bad news to a simulated patient. And then the audience critiques it. What worked? What didn't work? There was a fascinating revelation last year around one word. So someone sat down and said, I need to tell you that your scan shows brain mets. In a very gentle, kind way. And then the next person sat down and said, well, your scan shows brain mets. And the difference was the word well. And that one word had a tremendous impact that said, this is hard for me to, I'm pausing a moment because this is hard for me to say. I really do care about this. And so making discoveries like that, where one word can make such a difference, have been fascinating at Miami. Absolutely fascinating.
And aside from the Miami Breast Cancer Conference, you've also been a chair and you're on the advisory board for the Giants of Cancer Care program from Arc Live. What do you think it is about this program that not only keeps you coming back for more each year, but that you're really excited to just be a part of? And what's the uniqueness of this program?
So I have to give credit to Michael J. Hennessy for identifying a need and filling it, something Mike has done throughout his career. So there is a bowling hall of fame. There's a crocheting hall of fame. I'm sure that there's a several broadcaster right. and interviewer hall of fames, which I would suggest you
into. Thanks.
But there was not an oncology hall of fame, not virtual, not real, nothing. And so Giants of Cancer Care is an attempt to create a virtual hall of fame. It is a tribute to the shoulders of the giants we stand on today as we make advances. And so there have only been about, up until this year, there were 50 inductees. When you imagine that there are 40 or 50,000 oncologists out there who work, who do research, who many of whom are thought leaders, it is much harder to get into the Giants of Cancer Care than the Baseball Hall of Fame. The numbers are way harder for the Giants.
Yep.
And so I think it's important that the next generation of oncologists understand what got them where they are today. And I know that sounds like an old surgeon preaching, but it's really not. So much of what we embrace today, we understand because of a foundation that was built by someone else in a different time frame. So Giants of Cancer Care takes those rarefied individuals who worked hard, who sacrificed, who fought and fought and fought and made advances. And that's what's really cool. And that's why I will, I was chair of the program for 2 years. I remain on the board. I will never not be involved with Giants of Cancer Care.
Well, good. We're very happy to have you on it. I want to close with kind of with looking back at this amazing career that you have had and continue to have. Is there one moment, one case, one specific patient that really has had such a lifelong impact on you and really changed your practice or just changed the way you think about things? Or what's that one moment or person that you've had?
Yeah. So I'm getting chills. About 15 years ago, I met a woman who had survived a house fire. And she had suffered a 95% body burn, second and third degree burns.
Wow.
She had had 250 different skin grafting operations. And after this nightmarish sequence of events, she was found to have a breast cancer. Oh. So underneath all of this scar tissue where her breast skin was an aggressive stage 2 breast cancer. I did her surgery operating through skin grafts. We used hyperbaric oxygen to heal her. It took months. Mm. So about 6 years later, she was alive and well. And when I was leaving Memorial, they said, we'd like you to bring your favorite patient in to introduce to the audience. And of course, I brought Dorothy in. Mm. And Dorothy sat down and told this audience of surgeons and oncologists, big audience, maybe 300 people in the audience, how lucky she was in her life and how precious life was and all the things that she had learned along the way. Now, this was the pre-iPhone generation, but someone actually had a video camera the audience.
What are the odds?
So, what are the odds? Yeah, today it would be amazing if it didn't happen, right?
Yep.
And so Dorothy's speech to us was the most important moment of my professional life. We had played a small role in her health and well-being, and we knew that. But we developed a friendship that has been long-lasting. And what an amazing human being, and what an important message to us today to live every day to the fullest, and how lucky we all are with our little daily traffic complaints and my coffee isn't great and there's a line at Starbucks. And so it makes me thankful for the career that I've chosen. I feel incredibly lucky. I still thank my patients for trusting their care to me. I hope to do it for a few more years.
Dr. Borgen, thank you so much for being here today.
It's my pleasure.
And we can't wait to work with you again soon.
Can't wait. Thank you, Gina.
That's all we have time for today. Thank you for listening to this special episode and our 50th episode of Enclave On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews with top KOLs in the oncology field. For more updates on oncology care, be sure to visit www.enclave.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Enclave is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at Enclave and at Enclave SOSS. On Facebook, like us at Enclave and Enclave State of the Science Summit, and follow our Enclave page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of Enclave On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Enclave On Air.